WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective. I am Jason Mann. Before we begin, I want to tell you about our sponsor, RudoReels.com. It is a great place to find DVDs and downloads of the best of wrestling in United States, Canada, Mexico, Japan, pretty much anywhere that they have professional wrestling. So check out RudoReels.com. And my guest today, he is a common on WrestleSpective. In fact, I counted today and we have done 20 one-on-one conversations together between our two podcasts. Returning to the show, Kay Sawyer Paul.
I think that's about half as many as Sting and Vader actually had on pay-per-view.
I believe so. They did have a lot of matches.
Mm-hmm.
And today we're going to talk about their final pay-per-view match. It is Slamboree 1994.
Was this really it? This was the last time these two hooked up on pay-per-view?
I believe so.
Wow.
Yeah. They had, you know, a number of pay-per-view matches from basically 92 to 94, and all of them were pretty great. And this, I don't...
Yeah, my memory is that every single show that WCW put on... I know this is incorrect, but I feel like every single show they put on from 92 to 94 was headlined by Sting and Vader.
Yeah, it does.
That's sort of how it felt. It's like, remember how, like, in 2009 it felt like Orton and Cena headlined every single show, but they only headlined, like, 10 of them?
Right.
Yeah. Like that.
Indeed. Indeed. So the... at the beginning of the show, the commissioner, Nick Bockwinkel, announces that the WCW International World title, which had been held by Rick Rude, in fact, Rude had beaten Sting for it, was going to be returned to Sting because of the nefarious way in which Rude won the match. In reality, Rude suffered a career-ending injury in that match, which took place in Japan. Mm-hmm. But Sting refuses and wants to be won in the ring, so they set the main events of the show as Sting versus Vader at the end. So it's interesting they went into the show without really a main event, although they were building to Rude versus Vader, which of course was a heel versus heel. And based on the promos and stuff that I've seen, there wasn't really necessarily a good guy in that situation.
Yeah, super, super odd build-up. It's, I mean, WCW was always known for being a little more loose with the good guy, bad guy analogies. Like, their good guys were always a little bit more, a little rougher around the edges than WWE's good guys. Like, even Sting. It's funny. A few minutes into this match, Bobby Heenan makes a non-sequitur comment about Sting. He's like, everybody loves him. I don't get it. Why? He cheats just like everybody else. And I think it's that Bobby Heenan wasn't quite used to the way that good guys in WCW acted on a regular basis.
Yeah. Well, although Hogan was kind of the same way, even in WWE.
Hogan's a different story. He's been a bad guy his whole life.
Well, okay. All right. I'll grant you that one. And also, the funny thing is Flair, the other world title match, Flair faces a mystery opponent who ends up being Barry Windham in this match. So it was sort of like a show without really a main event ahead of time, although one of the big matches was actually the Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan against the Nasty Boys, the sort of the big rematch that had Max Payne instead of Cactus Jack, or instead of Sullivan, but it was, you know, that whole feud was kind of one of the bigger things that were going on, one of the few times where the tag teams really were the top thing, at least in this era.
Right.
Yeah. So, great matches, too. Very, 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 very violent. So, and I also noticed that I probably been watching a little bit more of, like, 92, 93 WCW, but 94, definitely, they were starting with the juiced-up production, the bigger lights, kind of the bigger pyro. The music, like, I wouldn't call it anywhere good, but it was at least like more sophisticated music than they had had the year before. You know, it was kind of, it was I think around that time they put together like the Slam Jam album, which had all these like kind of bad country songs and so on and so forth. But at least they were individualized themes for the wrestlers.
Right.
Hogan was on the way too. I think that may have been part of that, where they were trying to dress things up for getting ready for Hogan.
I think so. Yeah. This is around the same time they started doing the Disney tapings too, right?
Yes, which caused a lot of problems with the title that we're speaking of. They started those in 93, and they were still kind of going during this time.
Right. And we'll get to the weirdness of this title after this match.
Right.
But let's kind of get started. So Vader and Sting, it's so weird. I don't know play by play. They start, like, the first minute of this match, they're sort of hesitant to get it on. Really, which is weird considering how many times these two have. It's sort of the kind of thing that you'd have the first time.
Yeah.
People would lock up, but like these two have headlined so many shows in the last couple of years that it's weird that they take their time getting into it.
Yeah, I think the idea is maybe like they know each other so well that they're being cautious. Like they know like what the tendency of the others is, and they want to avoid the trap, so to speak.
But then Sting gets into the exact same trap that everyone gets into in the first few minutes with Vader, is that he gets into a corner like an idiot, and he gets pummeled.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they do some face-to-face, they do some trash talk, Vader backs off, and then Vader basically pushes Sting against the ropes. He breaks for a bait, it's a little flex, and then he misses a big clothesline, and eventually Sting gets caught in the corner. He gets a kick, but Vader lays in with a series of very, very stiff, tough punches. And mm-hmm. I love how Sting tumbles all the way from one corner to the other with that, and he's sort of like stunned, and the ref checks on him. It's like this, it's like a big boxing flurry kind of thing. It was really cool. It's not like I've never seen Vader do it before, but I've rarely seen it as well executed as between Vader and Sting was right here.
Yeah, I like that they close up on Sting, and he's just like shaking the cobwebs.
Right,
like he doesn't know what just happened, even though this is. Happened so many times to him.
Sure.
We have a
Sting Must Die chant as well during.
Oh, wasn't that cool?
Yeah, we're in Philly, so.
Yeah, it's funny again because they mic'd the WCW arenas so poorly so often. You rarely actually get chants on WCW shows, except for when they're in sort of smaller places like this. If I recall, was it a Clash of the Champions, the first pay-per-view of WCW without Flair, and there was that famous, like, show long, we want Flair chant? Yeah. Was that in a kind of a smaller place, too?
I think it was in Baltimore, so I think it was their regular arena, but the crowd may have been smaller than normal anyway. It was Great American Bash 91.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. So after that, we basically Sting gets up and gets pounded again into the corner, end of the canvas, gets hammered with a clothesline. The ref checks him again. And during this time, I like that Tony's kind of putting over like some of their top matches that they've had, like kind of going through some of the events of the rivalry. The first match at Great American Bash 92, where Vader won the title for the first time against Sting. Then King of Cable at Starrcade, they had a few others as well. Like you said, they seemed like they were on every single time. Then eventually Sting makes a big comeback, pummels him for a while, kicks him, then sends him through the rope onto the apron. And I love how Vader's sort of stunned on the outside. Clearly he's been, he's been hurt a little bit. His mask mm-hmm. comes off. Harley Race's manager goes out there to console him. And this allows Heenan to make fun of Vader's ram horns haircut. So I guess you have to be a tough guy to have a haircut like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
This is not Heenan's first show in WCW, but he hasn't been around for too long.
Yeah, roughly 6 months. I think he came around the end of 93. Mm-hmm. I forget the exact day, but I think he was there before 94, but just barely before.
Yeah, Schiavone hasn't started making fun of him yet.
No, not too much anyway. Their interplay here is pretty good. It's not mm-hmm. like it would get really mean spirited later mm-hmm. at certain times, but here it's not too bad.
Yeah, still professional.
Yes, yeah. Sting ends up pulling off a delayed vertical suplex, but he hurts his back, which he tends to do when he tries to slam Vader around. That's never really been his best strategy. But Sting just can't help himself because he's arrogant and he's a bad guy.
And he's stupid.
Yes. Well, we do know that Sting is a little bit gullible, that's for sure. So Sting stomps him for a bit. Then he charges and Vader does a body thrust. Sting doesn't move, though. He's not waylaid by this. Vader does it again, and Sting doesn't move. But the third one does work for Vader. Mm-hmm. Then I love the one thing about Vader that separates him from every other big guy or almost anyone else is like the precision that he would his strikes, the precision in which he would have punches or in this case an elbow drop right to Sting's thigh.
Yeah.
Like it's the perfect position. Everything is so high impact. It just looks so brutal and so incredible. And I think it's that, not just the force of it, but the precision of it, I think that really separates Vader from just about anybody else.
It's very true. That I'm just watching that shot again right now, and it's brutal. Mm-hmm. You're right. It's not just brutal. It's precise.
Right.
It's an excellence of execution style thing.
Yes. Very, very good point. Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, this is where you realize, and people watching this match may not realize, but like, this is where you get it, that Vader is not just like a 400-pound machine. He's a phenomenal technical wrestler, too.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And it's one of those things where it's like, you just, every now and then, a big man attacks a little man so well that you actually think that the little guy won't get back up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. It's not just how, it's where, it's, and he does it so fast too. And that WCW camera, I remember you and, I forget who you were talking with, but it was a couple episodes ago. You guys were talking about how the WCW camera system was so cool. Mm-hmm. And so like they would zoom in on different places than WWE cameras do. And they do it here. They get right in on the face of Vader and Sting.
Yeah.
And I love that Vader just starts like pawing Sting's head and taunting him.
Yeah. I mean, everything that was great about their dynamic is really just put in full effect here. There's no wasted like motion or anything. Mm-mm. Like that was unnecessary to the match. Everything there is just perfect and precise and just works. Mm-hmm. You know, really very well. So Sting hits Vader hits a big pump splash, but only gets two. He covers again. Sting gets the ropes this time, and then Vader decides to put a little bit of bad mouth on Sting, you know, yelling at him about how does it feel, and you know, talking trash to him, which is always fun. Then Vader grapevines the back leg, and I love Sting sells it just like Ric Flair would, just with the oh god, mm-hmm. and with the I'm in the, you know, the most horrible pain ever. Vader grabs the shoulder too as well. He gets a big headbutt and punches, and eventually Vader stands up, lifts his arms, and plays to the crowd after he's pummeled Sting to oblivion.
Yeah.
And then Sting does eventually get up, but then Vader kicks him in the back of the leg, and then Vader does another leg submission, but Sting's able to kick out of this one. Vader goes back up, though. He clubs Sting more in the corner. Sting gets a flurry to come back, and Vader goes down, which is, I think, the first time he's actually gone down from, you know, just top to the ground. There was one where he was pushed outside, but it wasn't quite the same. Then Sting does a big elbow drop to Vader's ribs, and you hear Vader, you know, screaming as well. And meanwhile, Harley Race is going crazy in the corner, yelling at Vader, telling him to hit him. Vader eventually gets back up. He hits a big elbow drop, rolls Sting over, and then drops it again. He grabs an armbar, but Sting gets out of it with a thumb to the eye. And then Sting accidentally clotheslines the ref. And Vader grabs a choke slam, but because he knocked out Randy Anderson, who I believe Michael Buffer called Randy Peterson, in a lack of professionalism on Michael Buffer's part. There's no one to count there. So Vader slowly makes his way to
Can I just stop you there? Is it weird that Vader gets the sort of false hope spot? Like that spot of like the, oh, I finally get the actual pinfall, but the ref's not in position. That's usually the good guy doing that.
Yeah, my guess is it's probably this is more like a protection thing of Vader, like because they still, like I imagine that, you know, they know Hogan's coming in. They know Vader eventually is going to be the guy who faces Hogan. They don't want Vader in the title picture, but they don't. They want to protect him for the eventual time for Hogan. So this is kind of his way of having like a claim that he could have won this match if it hadn't been for that.
Sure,
that's the kind of my guess. But you're right. That's usually. They don't do it. I mean, I've seen heels get visual pinfalls here and there, but yes, it's not as common, obviously, as good guys having it.
Mm-hmm.
So Vader gets accidentally nailed with a chair by Harley Race.
Well, does he?
Well,
like, would you be hurt by that chair shot?
Okay, it wasn't the best chair shot in the world.
Harley Race was so good at so many things, but chair shots were not one of them.
Not really, no. Sting DDTs Vader. The ref gets up, but it's only for two. Then Sting goes off the top, clotheslines Vader, he clotheslines Vader over the top. Suplexes him right away. Then Vader's right back up, but then Sting clotheslines him over. Vader's back on his feet, but clearly slower to get into the ring this time. Sting tries a Stinger splash, but Vader ends up catching him and slaying him down.
Harsh, too.
Very hard, yeah.
So harsh. Like, yeah. I thought that was it.
Yeah. No, this is a little bit weird. He goes.
I knew how the match was going to end, and I thought that was it.
Right. Exactly. Vader goes for the cover, but then decides to lift him up for some reason. Then at Race's demand request, Vader goes up to the top for the moonsault. Then he moves. Sting then covers Vader. And oddly, we get exactly the same finish as Starrcade 93, where Race goes the top rope, tries the headbutt.
Yeah.
Sting moves. He hits Vader. Then Anderson, the same referee, I believe, in Starrcade 93, ends up grabbing Harley and shoving him out.
Yeah.
And then Sting, in this case, Sting goes for a top rope splash and covers, and it's over. But basically, yeah, that was the whole same setup. So that was a little weird. Maybe just the whole – maybe they threw this together at the end, and that was the best they could come up with. But that's my only really nitpick with this match. It's really, really great otherwise.
It's so great. It's so tight. It's such a – it's such a like a wonderful like if you got to pick one of them, this is probably the one you're going to pick.
Mm-hmm.
All of like the best parts of their matches are in this match.
Yeah.
And it's so like it feels short, but it also feels perfect.
Right.
Like sometimes 15 minutes is all you need.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, you know, this may not be their best match, but this is certainly their most energetic, tightest match that I can think of, you know, as far as how it flows. And it's a really good, easy, if you really want to get into Vader and Sting, you don't want to invest too much, you just kind of want to get a good sample of what they did, this is a really good choice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So at the end, we have Tony and Bobby recapping the events of the show. Vader, very, very angry. He swings a chair. He yells at Tony. I like that Heenan sucks up to Vader right away, and that sort of pacifies Vader, and he walks away. And you can tell that they live in fear of Vader every single moment, which is, you know, which is the right way to play that.
I know I do.
Yeah, I'm still scared of him, you know.
Sure.
He was on WWE TV not that long ago. He looked pretty ferocious to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, the WCW International Heavyweight Championship.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that, the genesis of this is because on recent podcasts I did with Andrew Goldstein on War Games 92, we talked a lot about guys who never really won the world championship. And I put Barry Windham and Rick Rude on that list, even though they held the NWA title and the WCW International title.
And you said you didn't really count this title as a major championship.
Right. Yeah, and the reason I would say, and you know, you kind of made the comparison to the, you know, the WWE title and the world title, where the WWE, you know, and both of those are considered world titles by most people, I guess. I think the difference there is that the WWE title and the world title at different times over the past decade, which it's been now since they introduced those titles, more than that, really, that each one has been the number one title in WWE at certain points. It's main evented shows. It's now the last couple of years, the world title's really kind of been brought down a level by who's held it and what type of stories and how important it's been to the shows. But I would still say that those have a better claim. To me, well, I'll just kind of go through the different stages that the NWA title in shifting into the WCW International title happened. There basically are three chapters of it.
Mm-hmm.
Ric Flair at the in 91 is fired from WCW.
As usual, this is Jim Herd's fault.
Right, this is Jim Herd's fault. So, although this wasn't really publicly acknowledged, he held both the NWA and WCW titles. But to anyone who was watching, it was just one title.
Yeah.
But at this point, he takes the NWA title with him. The WCW title is won by Lex Luger in a match against Barry Windham. And then the WCW title continues on its merry way for the next couple of years and is generally, if not the whole time, the number one title. Fast forward about a year and a half to August of 92. That summer, WCW decides to have a NWA tag team title tournament. They've kind of patched things up with the NWA. They have a new leadership with Bill Watts. They decide, okay, the value of the tradition of the NWA is worthwhile to us. We'll go ahead and do this tag tournament, which ended up basically unifying the WCW and NWA tag team titles within like 3 months after anyway, so kind of seemed pointless. But they also are like, oh yeah, they're bringing back the NWA title in Japan. Some of our guys are going to be in this tournament. I think they kind of follow it a little bit, but it's not really like a prominent thing on TV or anything. But it ends up with Masahiro Chono beating Rick Rude in a tournament final to win the title. So the NWA title is basically like, it's sort of like this Japanese title. It is basically the way it's presented in WCW. It's like, it's important because it's Japanese and people in Japan take wrestling seriously, so that's why it's important. That's kind of like how 95% of stuff that happens in Japan is explained on North American TV. Does that sound about right to you?
It does entirely.
Yeah.
One of the things that makes this period of time in wrestling inexplicable, especially in WCW, is that, like, if you were watching WCW and you were watching it all the time, you were still only getting, like, half the show. Because a lot of their plot lines happened in Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was this crossover of talent, and sometimes Sting was in Japan, and sometimes he was here, and sometimes Rude was in Japan, and sometimes Vader was in Japan. And so you ended up missing a whole whack of stuff under no fault of your own.
Yeah. I don't know if it was as much story, if it was just great matches, but certainly, yeah.
That's what I mean, because all of the stories were crazy.
Sure. So, basically, yeah, for the next 6 months or so, Chono has it for a while. He and Rick Rude have a really weird match at Halloween Havoc 92, but that's basically the main NWA title defense by Chono in WCW. He loses it to Great Muda. Then Great Muda loses it to Barry Windham right as Ric Flair is coming back into WCW. So the Japan phase is over. Now we're into the giving the title to Windham to build to Ric Flair winning the title again, which is what they do. Windham wins it in February 93, and then July of 93, after a few months of feuding and Flair and Arn Anderson also messing around with the Hollywood Blondes, which we talked about before. Finally, Flair wins it in kind of a weird match, actually, at Beach Blast 93. Then the NWA title continues for a couple of months until WCW and NWA have a falling out over... I don't know if it's entirely clear, but my understanding is it had to do with who... WCW wanted to put that title on. Like, as you mentioned before, they did a lot of the Disney tapings, which meant that they basically taped their shows in advance for months. So if you were paying attention on the internet, then you could know the results and who, you know, a champion could be in 5 or 6 months. And they transitioned it to Rick Rude, but by the time Rick Rude won it, it basically stopped being the NWA title and became the WCW International title. And then basically this sort of begins the third phase of Rick Rude holding it and sort of trading it with different guys, including Sting. And then about a month after this, after the Slamboree 94 event, they do a Clash of the Champions with Ric Flair and Sting unifying the two titles. And then Ric Flair goes on and loses to Hulk Hogan.
I wonder if it's the dream of every young independent wrestling company to someday get big enough that they have a falling out with the NWA.
Well, yeah. No, TNA, basically the same thing happens. So, yeah, I wonder who the next one will be. I feel like it's like a Ring of Honor thing. That feels like something they would do. But
I think they're next. Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, basically, it's weird, like, in retrospect, how important people still felt the NWA was. Like, not, like, regular people, but like the people who were in charge of WCW felt like the NWA was, that they felt like they had to bring back that title when they had their own perfectly good title.
And didn't they, like, the NWA went from there, like, right to ECW, where Shane Douglas threw their belt down. Like this was not much later.
W was part of, yeah, it was one of the few promotions that were left in the NWA. One thing that's important that I didn't mention is that when the NWA withdrew their recognition of that title, for whatever reason, WCW got to keep the gold belt. So the physical title was still with WCW.
That's what confuses me to no end, is that the belt looks the same but has like 10 different names.
Yeah, they call it the big gold belt for a while, then they eventually call it the WCW International World Title. In fact, there's even, like, for a brief period of time, like, WCW announces that, like, oh, we're not sure if we're recognizing it as a world title. The executive committee has to meet over it. And then, like, a month later, they're like, oh, yeah, it's a world title. We're fine, you know. Some strange things going on. I did a decent amount of research on this. Thanks, by the way, to thehistoryofwwe.com. Resource to kind of help me out with that time, pro wrestling title as well. Good resources for that. But yeah, so you know, I'm still a little bit for whatever reason, for a long time, this has fascinated me, is like how you perceive this, that title, how people perceive the two titles, how they all, like, how the understanding thought of that at the time. They even really noticed that much. I mean, by the time by the time they brought back the NWA title, they understood there were two different titles. But if they understood how the separation ever happened or what happened, I guess it depends whether you just watch WCW or you watch WCW and Red Wrestling magazines, or if you watch WWE as well. Because obviously one of the big things with Flair coming in to WWE is that he had real world title, which is, you know, because for a while he had NWA title, or he had that physical belt because he paid deposit on whatever. So,
well, thanks for having me on. This does solve a couple of big questions that I had. I think we did this podcast eventually because I did sort of ask you what the deal was with this. So,
well, I switched it to the best. Hopefully, I feel like I've gone over different aspects of this title, like four or five. Podcast. So hopefully through all those things, I mean, as well as I possibly can. And if anyone finds that I've said anything wrong, or that, you know, they perceived it in a different way or whatever, they were watching, and they can explain how they understood it, I would always appreciate that. And best way to do that is to hit me on Twitter, WrestleSpective, or Facebook, or, you know, whatever means you like to communicate.
And just to plug myself a little bit, I'm at intlobject on Twitter, and I'm at internationalobject.com.
And you have a wonderful blog and podcast that you put out there, part of the Fair to Flair family.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Of course, check out rudoreels.com, and we'll be back to talk to you again soon.